Welcome to the second recording of AmScan Lit, a Velvel podcast series, which was initiated in the beginning of 2011. AmScan Lit intends to regularly archive the contemporary works of both emerging and established writers located in either America or Scandinavia. I'm Jacqueline Davis, recording from Los Angeles, specifically Echo Park. So if this recording has an echo, you know why. I'm here with SoCal artist and writer Andrea Lambert. We're going to discuss her first novel, titled Jet Set Desolate, which was published in 2009, by Future Fiction London, an imprint of Creation Books. In their own words, they publish a numbered series of sumptuous, transcendent fictional works. Ecstasy, Corporal Reality, Neo-Globalism, and The War on Delusion are Future Fiction London's foci. Andrea Lambert holds an MFA from CalArts and a BA from Reed College. Aside from Jet Set Desolate, Velvel Press also published her site-specific chapbook titled Lorazepam in the Valley of Skin, Extrapolations on Los Angeles, alongside the anonymously titled work 730910-2155 as part of the Velvel Poetic Duo series. Lambert's writings appear in 3M Magazine, you've probably read this before, Chronometry, and Lime Tea. Currently, she's working on a punk novella set in 1990s Portland called Scaffolding. For more information, visit andrealambert.tumblr.com. Andrea, after reading your book shortly following its release, I was relieved to discover how charged your text was in regards to 21st century sexuality, gender issues, the shared reality of post-millennial San Francisco for a recent graduate, disappointments associated with romance gone awry, dead-end job prospects, vapid sexcapades, the universal search for true love, body image concerns, sadomasochism, pimp and hoe dichotomies, doses of violence and sweet addiction, the morning after, inferiority complexes, grappling with a time-sensitive womanhood, and in a way stemming from that, the rejection of conventional notions of motherhood and family. It's a seductive and generous debut, and I'm interested in seeing how your next work will unfold. The main character in Jet Set Desolate is named Lena Cosentino. She is a woman in her late 20s, though flashbacks happen when she is in her early 30s, struggling to make it in a modern-day San Francisco. Can you tell us more regarding how you made decisions on how to develop this female protagonist?
I began this novel with very little distance between myself and the main character. I was, in 2003, living in San Francisco and struggling with many of the same problems that Lena faces. As the manuscript passed through CalArts and was drastically rewritten, the truthfulness of the narrative became diluted and blended into what would make it for a tighter and more readable novel. Throughout, however, I was concerned with developing Lena along the same lines as I had developed in those years before leaving San Francisco in 2005. Issues of loneliness amidst the urban environment, the rapidly diminishing allure of nightclubs that had once seemed radiant, the struggles of mental illness in the corporate world, and the inevitable unemployment and poverty that results. I wanted her to seem real and not to turn away from real problems that I felt were being addressed in, say, Chick Lit.
The title of your other recently published work, Lorazepam in the Valley of Skin, possesses a similar title to the famed pulp fiction novel titled Valley of the Dolls. Dolls, of course, being a slang term for over-the-counter pharmaceuticals, barbiturates, sleeping aids, pills. Consuming these in large quantities as a coping mechanism is a running theme throughout Valley of the Dolls. Pill-popping, fame, fortune, and the disillusionment which comes with chasing stardom are prevalent issues in Valley of the Dolls, a classic American novel set in both New York City and Los Angeles with the transatlantic period between these interims. I've discovered similarities in content, plot, and narrative arc between Valley of the Dolls and Jet Set Desolate, whether intentional or simply paying homage by adding your new voice to the pulp fiction genre, or 21st century variation of it. How much is the content of your literary works, either your novel or your chapbook, influenced by this previous work or other pulp fiction works?
Valley of the Dolls is my favorite trash fiction. Both the book and the film, even the soundtrack, which I have on record, are deliberate threads. I think the core of the homage in my work is the fact that I find such solace and similarities in these narratives to parts of my own life. I once moved to the big city with naive dreams. I never achieved fame and fortune, of course, but much like the Troyad and Valley of the Dolls, my dreams were crushed by mental illness and narcotics. And that is the story I tried to tell in Jet Set Desolate, weaving together and embellishing these threads quite deliberately. And the dolls. I've taken pills every day since I was 18 due to bipolar disorder, and I adored the way that the Valley of the Dolls film made pill-popping look so glamorous. In actuality, it is stigmatized or inappropriate, that which we don't talk about, and the bold, flamboyant strokes which illustrated Valley of the Dolls really validated me in my own lonely medication regime.
Why did you choose to write in first person in Jet Set Desolate?
The novel was first written in third person. It was during the CalArts rewrites, under the mentorship of Matthias Wagner, that I decided to switch it to first person for greater immediacy and so that the reader could share Lena's thoughts and emotions with greater empathy.
Much of the narrative in Valley of the Dolls is drawn from the author's experiences and observations as a struggling actress in Hollywood of the early 40s. Is this structural parallel to Lena Cosentino's San Fran narrative deliberate or merely a coincidence?
It is deliberate.
Are any of the characters in Jet Set Desolate based on real people? And if so, how much of what happens in your novel is based on actual individuals or true circumstances you have witnessed or experienced firsthand?
Most, if not all, of the characters are based on real people. Several of the main characters are composites, based on several people I knew at different times in my life. Much of what takes place is based on actual circumstances that I have witnessed or lived firsthand. Without naming actual particulars, which could be really dicey, I would say it's 75% true.
Have you ever been accused by a close friend or acquaintance of stealing or borrowing, as some like to say, their identity, or using facts about anyone's real life for the benefit of your literary projects?
Yes, one of the two people whom Jesse is based on tracked me down over the internet and located me through my website. He was an actual ex-boyfriend of mine, an abusive one, and I had been planning on using his real name, thinking he was lost to time, history, and heroin addiction. That was rather naive of me. I quickly reconsidered, emailed my publisher with last-minute name changes, and embarked on upon a bizarre getting-to-know-you, hope-you-won't-try-to-kill-me dance over email. He did accuse me of stealing his identity, but he was actually rather proud of it. He seemed to think it would gain him some sort of fame or notoriety, not realizing that small-press novels don't sell terribly well.
Does your personal narrative in any way bleed into your artistic practice, and if so, how?
Oh, relentlessly. My work is relentlessly personal. Embarrassingly so. I could say this is because I am terribly self-absorbed, or because I feel I have a unique perspective as a disabled lesbian alcoholic on SSDI. Perhaps it is an inability to see outside of the self. Perhaps I just think I'm so interesting. People have given me a lot of grief for it, because my writing has always been this way.
What sociopolitical issues, if any, were present in your mind before or during the construction of Jet Set Desolate?
At first, I wanted to write a drug novel that escaped the traditional sin and redemption narrative. I wanted to write a feminist novel that rejected the ideal of finding a perfect love. I wanted to write with the development of the internet as a subtext. And I wanted a female protagonist that rejected sentimental attachments and could pursue transitory hookups in the ways that real women do.
It can be said that many of the characters in Jet Set Desolate attempt to stretch the boundaries of the pleasure-pain continuum. At one point in your novel, Lena's ex-boyfriend Jesse rapes her, and while she is out having drinks with another man, Lena leaves her date for a moment to freshen up, encounters Jesse in another part of the bar, then Jesse has his way with her near a fish-filled aquarium out of sight from the other customers. The way in which this scene is described can be ambivalent for the reader. It is hard to discern whether or not the rape is unpleasant or whether Lena secretly desires it. Also, Lena doesn't seem emotionally affected by the incident in a predictably dramatic way. The story quickly moves forward as if nothing happened at all. I'm going to read the scene now. The book is unpaginated, but it's approximately halfway through. His eyes trace my hair, blurred. Come on, Lena, think about it. We could get back together. It would be different. He ducked his head, stepping back momentarily into the shadow. I've got my shit together now. I wavered, remembering his arm on my shoulder as we slept. Waking up in a summer night with him to compare nightmares with. Striding through the Tenderloin, arm in arm, with a half pint of Jack and the union of two fuck-ups against the fierce and glittering world. His pinball eyes bore into me. We could, he said. We could try. The sharp path of a razor passed the hula shower curtain, diving into the algae strands at my feet. An ashtray blown through the light bulbs, smoking blue and metallic. Don't you want to be my Sedgwick? My Nico? Yeah, and end up dead before my time? You're no more Warhol than Chris Danger. I'm gonna be bigger. You might want to get some talent first. I'm going back to my boyfriend. He's waiting for me. I turned away, seeing the long stretch of hallway beckoning me. I started to walk, and as I walked, the red walls closed around me, and I could only see the patterns of the wallpaper, the gold flowers and loops, mountains to climb with my hand tracing the velvet. I let his stare fall behind me as I climbed, quicker now. I heard footsteps, felt a hand on my shoulder. He grabbed me, wrenched me back. I fell forwards, scrambled, punched, and grappled for his shoulders and missed. His hand covered my mouth. I kicked him in the balls, and he yelped and fell backwards, enough for me to wrestle away. I ran through a side door and found myself on a long, narrow passageway, with concrete walls and a plank rising to another room. I slid my hand along the wall and tiptoed down to the milk crate, holding down the plank. I lifted myself to the cubbyhole, wiggling my shoe free from the plastic lattice, and saw the open top of the fish tank that sat behind the bar. A tub of mixed nuts sat above with a wad of lettuce hanging in the water. I moved closer, awestruck. The blue ills, streaked with lemon, the crimson beta, spliced with white, all waft delicately above the ground. Duct tape lined the cardboard top. I stared at the fish. His long nails gouged into my shoulders, and he pushed me forwards. With my nose an inch from the water, Jesse ripped my skirt up and pulled off my polka dot panties. He dropped them in the fish tank, and I watched them drift slowly through the algae. He was hard immediately, gripping my hair with one hand and shoving his cock in my ass with the other. I was getting ass-raped with the fishies. How did I get here? The numb nose, my body cold, the embarrassment of being caught at Delfina's with this loser, and by Ian, and oh lord, Audrey would not be kind. I would be 86th. Better just to wait until he finished. Finally he squirted what felt like a gallon of Hep C cum in my anus, and for good measure shook some down for the fish. My face against the water, I watched the eels nibble at it. Jesse slapped me on the ass and said, "There you go, tiger, bet you forgot what that was like." Blank, blank, cold. No presence was survival. Distance was strength. Andrea, what conclusions do you wish for your reader to extract from this particular scene, if any?
Lena's so desensitized by what she has been through that this seems like just another inroad upon an already damaged psyche.
Do you have a favorite chapter or section from Jet Set Desolate that you like more than the others, or are you particularly happy with how that section had turned out in comparison to the others?
There's a few parts I like more than others. There's some that I really enjoy and some that I'm sort of, you know, less happy with.
Andrea will now read a longer excerpt of her choice for the audience.
Trudging into the house, I slumped my way onto the couch, bending my tense neck to sore positions on the upholstery. Brady was bustling around the kitchen, wiping down countertops with a Clorox wipe. I watched him for a few minutes, digging the back of my head into the sagging gold afghan draped over the couch. I splayed my hands on my thighs, watching the jagged, dirty nails, last month's manicure chipped rough from too many nights digging apart my mirror for the last gasoline grains. White birds. Nothing at all by the end of the night. I dug a hand into my bare legs, scraping the razor burn where my cheap bit had scraped the delicate skin. Nothing about me was delicate anymore. I was bare adrenaline and splinters. Raising my eyes, I turned to where Brady was finishing up. He daubed the stained faucet with the wipe, then flicked it in the air and shoved it in the trash. His eyes dashed upward and his head fell again. "Where have you been?" "Oh, I was at Bordello." "Again?" "Oh, and again. And this time I got caught with drugs. Seriously, this cocoa chick I met at the hospital. She's great, sure, a little crazy, but it really wasn't her fault. I've done the same thing too a bunch of times, and this time I finally got caught with it." He came over and sat next to me, his long white hands like white lizards on the couch. He shrugged, and the shadow of his head stretched out along the wall. Purple and red tatters down his arm, along the wall. "Sounds like a pain. Embarrassing." "Oh, yes, and Jesse was there. Oh, Lord." He held out his hands. The red inside of his cuffs folded back velvet. I looked around, the shadows dancing over the TV, in the corner by the fridge. We sat in silence for a moment. "Listen, I'm really sorry about the other night," he said. "No, I am. I was being ridiculous." "You're being honest. I'm afraid of honesty." He looked at me, and the wolf blue of his eyes told me. When I get too close to people, especially when I live with them, it's like this automatic distancing happens sometimes. Intimacy. It's hard. "I used to know this girl, lived at the 13th and Failing House, and she had, 'When you have no one can hurt you,' tattooed above her breasts." "Here." He got up and went to the fridge, skidding a second on the wet tile. The refrigerator leaked constantly, and the landlord refused to fix it. There was nothing we could do. Brady skidded, righted himself, and opened the door, pulling out a half-eaten chocolate cake with a wax 3 lurching against a 5. The candles were edged with mouse-eaten blue, the white wax caked with red from the plastic box. The 5 lurched against the plastic, then fell sideways. "Do you want some cake?" He set it against the coffee table, the ashtray filled with olive pits and coffee grounds spilling onto the burgundy cloth. I smiled, despite myself, and reached out a hand to pick a stray slice from falling into a butt. "Take that one," he said. "It was my birthday today. They gave me this at the food bank." "Oh my God, you didn't tell me." "I don't like telling people it's my birthday. It seems like I'm asking them to make a big thing over me. When I feel I can't really ask that of people, it's not my right." He shrugged again and leaned over to take a slice. I gripped mine in the hollow of my hand and said, "I know what you mean. A couple of years ago, I didn't tell anyone it was my birthday and spent it with a bowl of ramen and some amaretto. Then my friend came over, shot up in my room. I didn't have any furniture. I just moved up to my old studio. And she just passed out. So I finished the bottle and did too. Next day, I went to work." "You always seem to just get up and go to work. How do you do it?" "Well, not always. There are always those days when I call in sick. It's mainly just that with temping, I only work a few days a week, so I can balance out when I get fucked up and when I don't. I'm not really that good at it, though. I tend to get fucked up all the time, and then I just show up shaking and sweating. Well, I guess you do what you can. I guess you could say that. It's still not good, though. I seriously don't know how I'm going to keep this job. God, I don't know what to tell you. Clench your teeth. Go in and don't talk to anyone. Yeah, that's what I do. I go and I don't talk to anyone, and they let me go at 5. I just wait it out. I sit it out. When you temp, they don't really expect you to actually do anything. That's pretty nice. I suppose, except after a while, you forget how to do anything until you can't do anything. You're just this useless wait doll, and all you do is wait for 8 hours to pass till you can go get fucked up, and blast out the fact that you have to go back tomorrow when you don't know what you're doing or where you want to go. Oh, ideological discontent. Come on. I want to do something. What? I don't know. That's the problem. I can't figure it out. I can't figure out what I want to do or how to get past my problems. If Jesse called right now, I'd run to my room and pick out the perfect panties. All of this. Gone. Thanks for the cake. Lena, listen. You'll figure it out. Everyone goes through this stuff. Just remember to breathe deeply and you'll work it out. Think. At least you're alive. At least you're out of the psych ward. At least you're not pregnant. Yeah, at least I'm not pregnant. Be grateful for the small things. Chicken soup for the crackhead soul. I left. I rolled a bent fork between my hands, plucking it from the table and tucking it between my fingers. The moon outside was indistinguishable from the streetlights streaming through the window. Brady nodded his head slowly and reached for more frosting.
Andrea, thanks for taking the time to meet with me on this perfect sunny day in Echo Park. You'd never believe it was winter. Such a deceptive city it can be. Visit www.velvo.se for upcoming AmScan Lit podcasts. Thank you for listening.